It's another edition of the Falls Cast, brought to you by the Falls Free Press in beautiful Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, where today, Tuesday, October 6th, it is, you know, fully fall at this point. It's been in the 60s today and beautiful, although admittedly there's a dark cloud hanging in the sky because the world lost Eddie Van Halen today, and I'm pretty sad about it, so... You know, I watched a 13-minute eruption on YouTube, and that's where my mood is right now.
Stupid 2020. 2020 can bite it.
Yeah, it can do something bad. Mm. We are here with some of our favorite Fallscasters this evening, including our nerd culture expert and my movie buddy, because we went and saw Tenet together, like, what, 2 weeks ago now, and I think Regal has now closed all its doors again since
Yeah,
then.
We got there right in time.
We had the whole theater to ourselves, so I'm not exactly surprised. It's Bart Sullivan, you guys.
Hello.
And we also have the lovely and talented Suzanne Searle.
Hello.
We have my best friend Mike Searle here, who dropped his hobby welding just to come to my house and show me how to build a fire the other night because I can't do adult things. So thank you and welcome to you, bestie.
Hello, everybody, and I still hate you, Alex. And I'm just a pyromaniac. I am just a pyromaniac. That's all I am.
You can't say you hate me when I've been gone for 3 weeks.
He did set his childhood home on fire, so.
Is that true? Did you do that?
That is a true story.
Yeah, that is a true story.
Oh, man. Take the welder away. Either that or make sure he's constantly in a good mood.
They were a Christmas ball.
It was a Christmas
incident.
Wreath. There was a Christmas light incident, and yeah, I caught the couch on fire.
Oh, my gosh.
Down in Cincinnati.
Well, it's a good thing that my fire pit's outdoors then, because it wasn't doing anything, and then you showed up, and it was like, oh, we have fire, ladies and gentlemen.
I have skills.
Yeah.
A special set of skills.
We'll leave that just hanging right there in the air. And
low-hanging fruit.
Not continue. Bart and I saw a trailer for a Liam Neeson film when we went and saw Tenet. And I think, what did I say? I think I turned to Bart and said, is this another Taken movie? But it wasn't. It was just, you know, the recycled script or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it definitely... But again, it's Liam Neeson, so he basically plays the same character in, you know, 90% of his movies.
That wasn't even the worst part of the trailers. We literally saw a trailer for a trailer of Dune. And I said to Bart at that moment, Did we just watch a trailer for a trailer? And he said, I think so.
For Dune?
Yeah, it was a trailer for a trailer for the film
Dune,
the forthcoming film Dune by Denis Villeneuve. My second favorite director. He's tied with Christopher Nolan, frankly. And I don't care that people hated Tenet. It was awesome. I'm just saying.
Yeah, if you can handle sounding like this and can understand people.
People who sound like Bane.
It's true. There were a couple of moments where it was hard to understand people, but they were wearing masks. I mean, if any time in our history, we can all understand how it's difficult to hear people when they're wearing masks. It's right now in 2020. Just saying.
I'm just saying I wish you had a mask on right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, we are conversing over the internet.
You know.
I know. I can go get one if you want. We'll edit this part out. Just kidding.
No, preferably a really tight duct tape sheet around your head.
Now it's just getting weird.
Garbage bag.
My God.
Jesus Christ. Yes, I'm an ass.
I'm sorry. He had some coffee before we did this, and I should have stopped him.
For That's 3 weeks, the inmates were running the asylum, and
this is what you get.
You know, Mike's a freaking orderly.
Alex is back. Woo, woo.
I have to get it all out now.
So after our roundtable discussion today, we will have my interview with James Lloyd Davis, who, as it happens, is one of the co-founders of the Falls Free Press. And just published an anthology of short fiction called Shrapnel, which you can get on Amazon Kindle or in print from Amazon also. I assume you guys all have read Jim's book by now, right? Right?
I actually read part of
some
it. Yeah, and it, you know, seemed very interesting. So
He's a very good writer.
He is.
I had read some of his short fiction before he published this piece, and he's got quite a voice.
Will he autograph it for us if we buy it?
You know, I bet you he would. I know where he lives, so we can just...
Yeah, do you? We'll go knock on his door. Hey, yeah. Somebody famous. Kind of cool.
It was a really cool conversation, especially if you're super into literature like I am. It's always cool to talk to an author about their work. And he didn't have any of the usual cop-outs, you know, that authors sometimes have when you talk to them about their work. Really candid. And Jim's just a really interesting guy anyway. So I hope everybody will hang around and check out that conversation about his book. So let's jump into some of the news. So last week during city council, they heard from a whole bunch of frustrated residents because there was legislation before them to allow a conditional zoning certificate. This property is zoned in a way that allows it to be used for different purposes as long as it meets certain requirements. So in this case, Conrad's Tire Express and Total Car Care, that company wants to build a car wash on Portage Trail Extension West next to the Giant Eagle Get-Go right there across from Humbird's Tower, which is what it's called, actually, not one of the many other colorful names for it. You know, it's the Cuyahoga Falls monstrosity.
I honestly didn't know what it was actually called, so now I know.
We aim to educate here on the Fallscast, even our own Fallscasters. So, yeah, that's where they proposed putting this new car wash. They met all the requirements they were supposed to meet, and council approved the measure 7-4. There was some sentiment that a no vote could trigger a lawsuit that the city would lose. Very likely. I mean, there's no way to know for sure, but based on all the factors, they would probably have lost the lawsuit. And so any money spent on the lawsuit would, you know, be money that would be taken away from, you know, I don't know, city programs, paying first responders, projects, whatever the case may be. The property in question is located in Ward 8, which is the ward of Councilman Frank Stams, the former Cleveland Brown who won last year to represent Ward 8. And so he voted no, and so did Councilman Mike Brillhart. Now, Mr. Brillhart and Mr. Stams are both Democrats. Ward 6 Councilman Adam Miller and at-large Councilman Jeff Iula, who are the two Republicans on council, also voted no on the project. But again, the measure passed, even though a whole bunch of residents expressed their frustration, particularly those along Cedar Woods Drive, whose properties will butt up against the new development. You know, things to know are that there's a new-ish car wash called Laser Wash, which is about a half mile from the property, right where the cake building used to be there on Portage Trail. And its owners actually sent in an email to express their objections. And then Quality Scrub, which is only about a third of a mile from the site right there on State Road across from where State and Graham meet. They didn't even send in any kind of comment or anything. Conrad's actually agreed to plant more trees along the back of the adjacent residential property than they even have to. They measured decibel levels at comparable car washes to ensure the volume wouldn't be too much for the area. I'm told they actually have it set up so that the engine that powers the vacuums that would be outside would be enclosed indoors, so the noise from the engine at least wouldn't make a whole bunch of noise, but you would still have the suction sound coming from the vacuums that would be outdoors. They even restricted hours beyond what would be required, so they won't stay open as late as they could. The LED lighting would have baffles on it to make sure that the light is aimed downwards and doesn't go out and disturb those adjacent properties. And then a couple things to know just is that the business would create 10 jobs. I think 4 of them would be full-time. It would generate some property tax on what was previously tax-exempt land, to the tune of $13,000 per year for Woodridge School District, and like a very small amount, $2,800 in tax revenue for the city each year. So, you know, there's a lot to this. and we should talk about it, but you know, ultimately I think probably there's some NIMBYism going on here. But the question is, you know, should the city council have listened to these residents and just, you know, rolled the dice on whether or not they might get sued if they didn't approve the project, since all the qualifications were met or the requirements were met? Or should they have done what they did, which is vote no, in order to avoid the possibility of a lawsuit, in spite of the fact that these residents along Cedarwoods Drive would be potentially disturbed by this car wash, keeping in mind, of course, that many of those same properties are adjacent to the Giant Eagle Get-Go, which is bright and its own kind of monstrosity if you live next to it, I suppose. What do you guys think?
Why another car wash? I mean, why do we need another car wash? I'm not sure the whole reason for it. I think city council probably had their arms tied. They had to probably vote for it. If they did everything that they needed to do, all their T's were crossed and their I's were dotted, what can city council do? But I would not want a car wash right by my house. I would be pretty upset about it. Even with everything that they're doing, I would still not be happy about it. And I just don't understand why we need another car wash or why they think this is a good idea. I mean, especially with what we have two that are so close to each other right now. I don't know. And what's going to happen with, you know, with the other car washes? Wasn't the laser, is it laser car wash?
Falls,
I don't want
to. Falls Laser Wash, yeah.
Falls, yeah, they just opened up. And they are a local company. They're locally owned. What's it going to do to their business? I don't know. I don't understand the reason for it. But I guess, long story short, yeah, city council probably, they did what they had to do and voted for it. We would not want to have to go into a lawsuit and have that money go towards, you know, defending their decision versus, you know, repairing some roads or programs or whatever else we can use with the money, because I don't think we would have won that lawsuit. I mean, we can't stop a business from, you know, doing what they want if they've done everything correctly and filled their forms up correctly, and you just can't stop it, unfortunately. So,
well, and if it's zoned in a certain way and they meet the requirements, which it sounds like they did, yeah, there's not much council can really do to stop nope. it. I mean, nope. it's no matter how much the residents may dislike it, similar to how the whole Sorek Trail debacle, mm-hmm. you know, if the, or French Mill, there were that was a big to do also.
Sycamore.
If it's zoned a certain, yeah, well, Sycamore, and they had a problem with French Mill before Sycamore, but it was zoned a certain way and they could develop how they wanted. So unfortunately, I mean, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but they met the requirements. They're allowed to build. But is it only going to be just a car wash? It's not like an auto care center like some of the other Conrads are also? It's just a car wash?
It's owned by Conrads, but it's just going to be a car wash. They have the whole plan. They know everything, what it's going to look like. It's just a matter of, you know, and they don't own the property yet either. The property is owned by the Engley, you know, church that's across the street.
Oh, okay.
And and for that reason, because it's owned by a church, it has been tax exempt all this time. Well, the church is ready to sell it, and Conrad's is ready to buy, but Conrad's doesn't want to buy to build a car wash if they're not allowed to build a car wash. And furthermore, even if city council had voted no, even if Conrad's hadn't sued them, I think Engley could have, because then that would have, like, you know,
possibly
screwed them over on the potential sale of the property as well. So before I inject any more of my opinion, Bart,
I see the issue with being in even if it's a commercial property, it's in a resident, if it's in a residential area, you gotta listen to what, you know, the people living in that area have to say. And I mean, I get, you know, yeah, they didn't want to get sued, but at the same time, yeah, there's a reason for the controversy over this. You know, people don't want to, what they're saying might end up being different than what actually happens at the end. They might be saying the motors, you know, are quiet, but, you know, until you are standing there next to a motor and can say whether or not you hear it.
I just don't understand why we need another one. I don't understand.
My sense is that if Conrad spent the money to create the plan, you know, study the decibel levels of other car washes, you know, go through all this hassle, they must have some business study somewhere that tells them that car washes are in a high enough demand that it would warrant having, you know, one a third a mile away and one a half a mile away, and still want to build it. One thing that I think is important to remember is that while there, it does seem excessive to have that many car washes, and I agree with that. You know, Mr. Gorbach, at large Councilman Gorbach, said at the end of that article, clarified that, like, you know, as far as like competition among businesses or the numbers of the same kinds of businesses, even, it's not the council's job to interfere in those kinds of matters. All they can do is determine whether, according to the law, the business that wants to buy this property has met the conditions that are necessary for them to be able to use that property for that purpose. And
yeah, that's true.
I think what the councilors who voted yes were essentially saying was that they believed the conditions had been met, even though they recognized, and I think they all did. Councilman Balthus, I think, unfortunately, has bared a bit of the brunt of this because he was quoted in the article, and he was one of the ones, I think, who pointed out that, you know, if they didn't approve this, that there's a good chance that they would be sued. You know, where others thought, you know, it's entirely possible that they wouldn't be sued and that Conrad would just take their ball and find another piece of property, you know. But there's no guarantee of that. And if that did happen, they might spend, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in court.
Well, Russ Balthus would know. I mean, being the former, you know, being the former law director, he would, you know, he probably would be able to be able to know what's going to happen on this. I would trust what he has to say on whether or not he thinks it's a potential lawsuit.
Yeah, and I think him getting beat up on, you know, on Talk of the Town a little bit, maybe, kind of removes a little bit of the benefit of the doubt there, because I think you're right. He does probably know better, maybe, than any of them what may happen under these circumstances if they were to vote it down.
Yep.
You know, there are lots of other circumstances that are similar to this. You know, there was one for a housing development. I think it was under the Robart administration. That was opposed, that actually went all the way to the Supreme Court in Cuyahoga Falls. And that housing development got built anyway. So I think there's a sense that, you know, the city is very unlikely to have won any potential lawsuit that would be associated with this if they were to vote it down. You would expect Councilman Stams to vote no, I think, because it's his ward and he's hearing from his constituents. And not even just as a political maneuver, but just because, you know, he wants to do what's right for his constituents and they're telling him they don't want it.
Well, it's to your point. It's similar to what former Councilman Riley said with the whole Sycamore debacle. Just because the residents don't necessarily want it there, if it's zoned a certain way, whether you want it there or not, if the developer wants to come in and build and meets the criteria, they're going to build. And that's, you know, as Drew had said, you know, he didn't necessarily agree with what they were doing, but by the zoning and by the law, he has to go along based on that. You know, he wasn't a big fan or proponent of what was going on down there, but by the rules and regulations, they met everything and they went along and built it, you know. And I mean, I understand to Bart's point, you know, if I remember right, the U-Haul storage facility over by the old Schwables, which, you know, they built all those storage units. I know his dad, you know, Tom, was upset about them building that because they were supposed to put in ditches and they were supposed to, you know, not have the open culverts, and they were supposed to put a fence around that. And that was part of the requirements of them building it. And they said they were going to do it, but they haven't built a fence yet. So I don't understand, you know, why they haven't done that yet. So that's something we possibly could hold them. You know, maybe they discussed it later on that it wasn't possible and maybe that went through council and I missed it. But I mean, at that time, they met the criteria and met the zoning requirements and blah, blah, blah. Even though the residents didn't like it, or, you know, the surrounding residents didn't necessarily like it, they discussed it. They went to council about it. You know, they pled their case, and unfortunately, they lost that case, and U-Haul now has all the storage there. So unfortunately, I mean, if Conrad's, you know, Total Auto Care met all the requirements, they've got the okay to build, they're going to build. And now they're going to try to do what they can to mitigate the problems with the residents of that area, you know, building the trees and the dampers for the LED lighting, and, you know, try to enclose the motors and or engines, you know, for the car washes. So they're trying to do what they can. And like you said, I'm sure they've done surveys and they've done studies and they've done, you know, sound pressure level readings and whatnot to try to do what they can as best they can and limit the hours of operation and whatnot. But unfortunately, I mean, it's sounds like they're going to go ahead with it. And I mean, I agree. I don't think we need a third one. You know, you've got three car washes now all within a half mile radius of everybody. But, you know, if that's what Conrad's wants to do, that's what they're going to do.
I think you made you brought up a good point with the U-Haul not building the fence like they said they were going to. And whether or not the city council, can they hold Conrad accountable if they say they're going to do all of this, but they ended up not doing it because of whatever reason, cost or whatever excuse that they want to give, if they don't end up actually putting the trees in and the noise level was higher than what they're saying, can city council hold them accountable for that? What, you know, what recourse would this, you know, the residents have to make sure that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing?
That's a good question. I know that because it's mixed use, some of the requirements that allow them to be able to build a car wash on that site come from the Planning Commission. And I think in this case, there were actually like certain things that were considered for this particular project that came in as a part of what happened in the Planning Commission. And that was what, you know, like when it made it through Planning Commission is when it got to City Council. And at that point, it was City Council's mm-hmm. duty to vote on it as is. Now, I don't know if the things that Conrad's says they're going to do that they don't even necessarily have to do are required. And to your point, like whether those things would be something where you could hold their feet to the fire to make sure that mm-hmm. they do it. That's a good question. We could probably ask the city. Maybe even Councilman Balthus we could ask, because he would probably know. To find out. But I honestly think that this is a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of a situation. You know, the Sycamore development, the issue there was that it was not zoned for what they wanted to do. It wasn't zoned for housing. If the property owner at Sycamore hadn't had the zoning changed, somebody else could have come along and bought it and put in more storage spaces or a warehouse or whatever. And I think that was one of the arguments that was being made at the time. Like, this property is going to go up for sale, and, you know, we can have housing, we can create property taxes, or, you know, for the school, or we can, you know, we can wait for, you know, another U-Haul place to come in, or another, you know, warehouse or factory or you know, whatever. So in that case, you know, they actually had to vote to change the zoning in order to allow that happen. In this case, it appears as though they have met all the requirements to be able to use the land for this purpose. So whether the residents like it or not, I don't think they really had any recourse. The only thing council could have done was to say no car wash goes in there, but then potentially the city gets sued. They win the lawsuit, Conrad's does, they build the car wash anyway, and then they wouldn't have to do any of the extra stuff they said they do, because at that point they would be able to point to a court ruling that says they can basically do whatever they want. So, you know, forget about the baffling on the LED lights, the names of the light downward. Forget about, you know, monitoring decibel levels and having fencing that baffles the sound and all those things. They just put in the car wash, you know, wherever whatever way they want, as long as they met the Planning Commission guidelines, and there you go. So I think that we should acknowledge that the council people, even the ones people in this conversation wouldn't necessarily agree with on a lot of stuff, genuinely care about the city and their constituents, and that they have a hard job in that sense. But that, you know, they're faced with difficult decisions a lot, and they do, you know, what they think is right. And in this case, the majority of them thought that the right thing to do was to let the project go forward, even though it wasn't going to keep everybody happy. And, you know, I think Councilman Balthus said something in that article, like he'd rather, you know, do the right thing and be unpopular than do something he doesn't really agree with and, you know, remain popular, be able to get reelected or, you know, whatever it is. So I don't think that's any of that kind of stuff was going through his mind. I think, you know, he's a...
And that is the life of a council person, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we'll move on then to this piece about the Summit County Board of Developmental Disabilities, which we also call Summit DD. You guys talked about this last week because I wasn't here, but another thing that was before the council was actually approving that project, and it has been approved. So this is the development where they're going to move beyond the existing building they already have. They're going to demolish a couple of buildings. I think one's even a house. Down by that Summit DD building, build an additional structure. The city's going to construct a parking lot. They say that the original plan is going to bring 100 jobs to the city, and this new additional plan that's just been approved is going to build another building that's about half again as large as the existing building and bring another 30 jobs to the city. Now that it's been approved, you know, the sense is that it's going to be completed by spring of 2022. And again, it's going to produce an additional $160,000 in annual income tax revenue, and a parking lot, you know, that would be constructed by the city, which wouldn't just serve Summit DD, but after hours, would expand, available downtown parking, you know, in an area that economically is popular. People go down there to shop and eat and stuff like that. So anytime you can put more parking in that area, it's great news for downtown. Plus, you're going to have all those people down there who will be looking for a place to go have lunch during their lunch break and shopping at the shops as they walk to Flurry's Cafe and whatever. So it's, I think, pretty good news. What do you guys think about that?
It's good. I guess. I mean, that's anytime we can, you know.
The parking lot thing kind of gets me is, I mean, that's, yeah, it'll benefit down there a little bit, but that'll benefit Moe's, I think, more than, you know, maybe Leo's and whatnot. I mean, it's a little bit of a walk to go down there. I mean, you have the parking deck and all that for Leo's and Flurry's and all that stuff around there. And that's kind of a walk, you know, if you're parking there to go all the way downtown, you know. But it's good for Moe's.
Yeah, and I mean, Moe's has been serving people in a parking lot across the street because of the pandemic.
Sure.
I think that's one of the old car dealerships.
That's the parking lots.
So that'll be, yeah, so that must be what's going to become the parking lot for this new Summit DD area. So I suppose that's good news unless the pandemic goes on for much longer, because then, you know, when the construction begins, Moe's won't be able to serve people in that parking lot anymore. But, you know, hopefully the pandemic won't be going on that much longer. You know, I've never eaten at Moe's. I'm going to have to do that.
Nearby.
I don't think I have.
I've
either.
Delivered there. Yeah. I've delivered wine there, and it's a nice establishment.
It's pretty nice, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah. Well, Stephen and Jen have eaten there, I believe, so...
Yeah?
Yeah, I think it's one of the more, like, upscale fine dining kind of places in the city.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, False Free Press field trip to
Moe's. Field trip. Yay.
Do I need a permission slip?
From your mother.
Oh.
Can I forge that one?
You that was a deep wound right there. That was a deep wound. You just went on that one.
I don't know anything about Mike's mother, but I'm assuming, I think I do now.
Yes, she died when I was 9, so. Oh,
well, now I am. So.
We'll open that wound up. 9 times.
Yeah,
number 9. Number 9.
Suzanne,
number 9.
You can have Suzanne sign it, but only if you start calling her mother, like Mike Pence.
Like Mike Pence. Mother. Is there going to be any other females there? Because he cannot be around any other females.
Okay. Does Alex qualify
as your mother?
Well, no, as a woman. He is a female.
You know, sexuality is a very complicated thing. Yeah. So is gender identity. I mean, let's
gender and sexuality. Okay.
Do we really want to get into this right now? I mean,
don't make me change the categories on the podcast. I've already had to do it twice.
You should.
You should do it twice.
You make it. You know,
no more work for Bart. No more work for Bart. Sorry, Bart.
So here's some good news. Howe Avenue is officially back open, like all the way.
Ooh, yay.
I mean, I don't really have a whole lot to say about this, but some of these facts I think are just kind of like amazing. This reconstruction took 6 months, first of all. Mm-hmm. Happened in the middle of a pandemic, by the way, which was already affecting business down there on Howe Avenue, I'm sure. And yet, you know, restaurants down there seemed pretty busy to me. Throughout, the whole thing cost $5.9 million. They replaced an entire concrete roadway with asphalt. They addressed draining issues. They installed new curbs and sidewalks, and they put in new lighting and signage. I think the businesses probably were super worried that the Howe Avenue construction was going to affect their business, and then the pandemic hit too. But, you know, again, I think that it looks to me like a lot of the businesses did okay in spite of all that. There was one restaurant that like added a second lane to its restaurant drive through, which is pretty incredible. I mean, it tells you how busy they were even with all this going on. This reconstruction project was actually funded by the Ohio Department of Transportation. But they actually needed the input of local leaders like city engineer, Tony DeMasi, and, because of that sort of partnership, they were able to ensure that the traffic patterns would accommodate the traffic in an effective way and help keep the businesses up and running in all those surrounding establishments during all the time this was going on. So as a huge project, did you guys have to drive down there while it was under construction?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's why they actually kind of quit during the holiday season last year. You know, they kind of quit doing the construction and stuff so you could at least get around and, you know, do what you need to do, which I think saved a lot of those places in the plaza, in the surrounding stores. I mean, that was, you know, Home Depot, Target, all them, you've got that easy bypass right off of, you know, Main over there. But, you know, some of those other ones, you know, in the plaza, that could have been the death of many of them, you know, but they're still there.
Our daughter worked up there. And we had to drive through there just to get her to the stores and the store that she worked at. And it was kind of crazy time sometimes when they closed up where you wanted to go. So
I feel like it was fine if you were approaching it from Newberry, like no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even if you were coming from the other end of Howe Avenue, like where the highway is, if you approached it that way, you know, you could go right or left and turn into the parking lot. And those parking lots actually have through roads that have names. Mm-hmm. I can't think of what those they're called.
Yeah, there's ways around it. That's how I had to go through like Newberry to get the back way to get in there. So there was ways to get around way. It.
Talmadge down to Clyde and come the back way, you know, by Five Guys, you know?
Yeah, I do that too. But the people who maybe aren't as familiar with the area, you know, say you're at Target and you need to get back on Highway 8, you come down, you come out down by the BP and you're trying to go left and then
right
onto Howe. I mean, you'd be there all day. Same thing on the other side. And actually, you're not allowed to turn left onto that street by Arby's. You have to go up to the light to turn left if you're like on Newberry. And a lot of people were just going left there anyway. And so it was really like, I wouldn't be surprised if there are some car accidents because of all that.
Shoot, we watched a couple of Sam's Club drivers, you know, making that right and that quick left and going through the plaza parking lot, trying to get up to Sam's Club.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude,
in semis?
I drive a semi. That's in semis. I'm
God. You know,
just go down to Independence and loop back around. I'm like, it's not that hard of a loop. I mean, that's why risk it? You know, that's a lot of small space to go through.
Yeah. But, well, Mike and I had the ability to drive on this new road because somebody didn't listen to me where we were going. What? So we accidentally got onto Howe Avenue, and it was nice. It was nice and smooth, so they did a good job.
Yeah, I just hope they open Moe's back up. I got to tell you, I love Moe's so much, and I'm so bummed out. It's been closed forever. I'm going to say this, and you guys can all just accept that this is the truth, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that is, Moe's is better than Chipotle.
What? Okay, you know what? I am starting to see a poll that we should put on our Falls Free Press Facebook page to see whether or not you are correct or not.
Even if I'm wrong, I'm right. Is that how you?
If you're wrong, you're still wrong.
Only in this case. I mean, you know, maybe
send
other cases. Send
all your emails to alexpaul@fallstreetpress.com.
I don't think that's a real email address.
It is, sir.
It can be. I can take it.
We can do it.
All right. Well, we'll let Mike check that address. No, I mean, honestly, it's for part of it is for a really selfish reason, and that is that they have tofu, and I don't eat meat. Chipotle has sofritas, which is made from tofu. I don't like it nearly as much as the tofu you get from Moe's. Plus, they have a freaking salsa bar, and when you get a to-go burrito from Moe's, they don't ask you if you want chips and salsa. They fill the bag with chips, and then they put a burrito in there. They give you a whole bag of chips, and then
why they fill it with chips? Because their burritos suck. Mm. That's why.
No, that's not why.
They give you so much cheese.
And they have bacon. They have bacon. True, and they do have bacon. But certain people won't eat bacon. I'm not going to name any names.
Well, he would eat fake bacon.
Bacon?
Which is
bacon? Yeah, I actually had a veggie bacon BLT right before this.
Is it just as good as regular bacon?
I'm sorry.
Listen, here's what you like about bacon. Smoke and salt.
The spices.
What you like about bacon is smoke and salt. You put smoke and salt on just about anything, it's gonna taste like bacon. I'm telling you, put on a roof tile, you'd be like, man, where did you get this bacon? Chewy.
That's all. Yeah.
Like, a little gritty though.
Hey, you know what? You've been watching Parks and Rec, right? Do you remember the whole where they were debating whether or not it was the fake burger versus the real burger? Did you watch that one recently?
I mean, I did, but I'm still drawing a blank. I watched the series twice, and I can't think of what it is now.
They were having.
Oh, I remember. Yeah. Ron Swanson and Rob Lowe's character.
Yes.
No, I remember Ron Swanson going, "Oh, that's vegetarian bacon. May I have some?" Right in the trash. May I have some? Right in the trash. Because that's where it belongs.
Well, that's fine.
Like candy corn.
I have some in my belly right now, and I feel good.
Okay.
Rye
Again,
bread.
Right.
Yeah.
All your complaints to alexhall@fallsfreepress.com.
So, Bart, how many categories are we up to now?
Sorry, Bart.
Well, it only left me have three, but so far, gender studies and foodie.
I don't remember doing gender studies. Oh, yes, I do. You're right. We did. That's a good point. Yes.
That's so 10 minutes
good
ago.
Good poll. And I know.
Anyway, it's good that Howe Avenue is back open. Cue yes. Transition hey. Music. All right, so let's wrap up with this. Once again, very important that we remind our readers of this very important information. Let me see how many more times I can say important information about voting in this year's elections. Monday, that's yesterday, we're recording this on Tuesday the 6th, was the deadline for voter registration, and that deadline is now passed. Hopefully you're registered to vote and making a plan to cast your ballot. Absentee ballots started mailing out on Tuesday, that's today, to those who requested them. I heard that we have 2 million requests for absentee ballots in the state of Ohio, which is double what they had in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So, so the absentee ballots should be on their way to you if you requested one. Remember that between October 6th and November 2nd, absentee voting by mail can take place. But so can early in-person voting at the county polling place next to the Board of Elections on Grant Street in Akron. I saw a picture today of a line way outside the polling place. There was a 2.5 hour wait, I'm told. And today was the first day you could early in-person vote. So that tells you something about turnout this year, that like day one, we've got a 2.5 hour wait. It's great news. Yeah. It's great news.
I saw a video from Franklin County that was, it had gone around, the line had gone around the building like 2 or 3 times.
Wow.
Yeah.
It didn't, somebody say it, Cuyahoga County was the same way.
Yeah. I did hear that. I did hear that. I heard Hamilton County down in the southwest part of the state, same way.
Cincitucky.
It's my old stomping grounds. Well, Hamiltucky, but whatever.
Hamiltucky.
Yeah. Hamiltucky. That's my people. If you plan... That's right, just down the hall. If you plan to vote absentee, October 31st is the deadline to request an absentee ballot. And November 2nd is the deadline to postmark your absentee ballot. November 3rd
is... Send it in early.
Yeah, get that thing in there.
Yes.
Quickly. No jokes, Mike. Get your ballot in there.
Do it, Mike.
And edit.
That was a good full belly laugh. I appreciate that. November 3rd is election day, and the polls are open 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. You know, I had volunteered to be a poll worker, and I went and I did the training. They said they need 1,800 people in Summit County to effectively run the polls. And as of that day when I was in there training to be a poll worker, they had 4,500 willing people.
Holy shit.
So I don't think I'm going to get called to work the polls, but it could happen. And now I'm trained, so I know how to do it if I need to.
Must not make poll joke.
Listen, voting is so, so important. Please, please, please make your voice heard. Get out there.
Vote.
I wrote please 3 times and said it 3 times.
You did.
I will read off an acrostic poem about voting.
If you're listening to this and you want to see what kind of crazy things we will do to encourage you to vote, make a suggestion, and we will very likely do it if it means you'll get out there and vote.
Wait, whoa. Why am I picturing myself doing these things and everyone else videotaping it?
Because you're always the one that volunteers.
Oh, fuck.
Wear a chicken suit with no pants. Mike will do it.
Oh, that would
I do that normally.
Please, people, write in.
That's
again,
just Saturday night for Mike.
ballsfreepress.com with your suggestions for my husband to do. He will do it.
He will. We'll take video. We'll blur out the nasty bits.
Yes.
It's all nasty, so just blur the whole thing out.
just vote written on your forehead.
Just do it.
It's like a headbang off with the word vote on our foreheads. Sounds great. I think you can take your absentee ballot to the polling place to drop it off too. If you don't feel comfortable sending it through the mail, you can take that absentee ballot right out of your mailbox, fill that sucker out, hop in the car, take it down to the Board of Elections, drop it off. They will count your vote.
Do it early. Make sure your signature is the same signature as what you have registered to vote for.
Yes, and where is the Board of Elections at?
It's on Grant Street in Akron, right by campus.
Yay.
Get
drop
that.
Drop it off there.
This election, there's some politician you don't like and you want him to go. Kick him in the ballot.
Kick him in the ballot.
Kick him in the ballot. Grab him by the ballot, people. Grab him by the ballot.
Grab him by the ballot. All right. You guys know what it's time for now? Are you ready?
Do we have a name for this? We have a name for this yet?
Yeah,
I think we just wound up with Bart's Arts Corner because we've gone 3 weeks without Alex, and I just sort of made it that.
Yeah.
I don't think you need the corner. It should just be Bart's Arts. Oh man, you know what this needs?
A song.
Theme song. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Bart's Arts.
I was gonna have Alex write it, but I like this one better.
I think we just recorded that, so I'll just keep that, and that'll just be.
Oh boy!
Tell us, Bart.
You do, Alex, you remember that I'm the one that posts these, right?
He has the ways.
Going to be a saboteur now. Bart, tell us of the art.
So, a couple things happened here in the past week or so. On September 26th, which, what day is that? Because I didn't look at a calendar.
It's many Scaramucci's ago.
Yeah.
Many Scaramucci's ago.
What?
Just go with it. Just go with it.
Well, now we're the saboteurs.
This is why I'm not editing this.
Steven's going to be so mad he wasn't on this one. Proceed.
So, about a little over a week ago on September 26th, Ballet Excel Ohio did a sort of flash mob down on Front Street near the amphitheater. They were looking for ways to, you know, pipe up the march in the community. And you know, we've seen a little bit happening right now, but, you know, there's not much going on. So they went down to Front Street and did a dance number to Happy.
I love that. That is such a great idea.
Well, they did it at Leo's, too. They're at Leo's and Falls River Square.
I know they did it on Falls River Square. I wasn't down there, so I don't know.
Oh, geez, Bart. Why weren't you down there?
It was a flash mob. No one knew until it happened.
You were supposed to know.
Hey, Mike, a flash mob is a thing where
yes.
people...
Uh-huh.
What is a flash mob? What, huh?
Well, usually when I flash...
Yeah,
mobs,
see, that's where I thought you were going to go. I think it would have been a lot cooler if they were all wearing like they were dressed like if they were all dressed like Punky Brewster, and instead of doing it to Happy, they did it to Weird Al Yankovic's parody, which is called Tacky. That would
see that song has been in my head all day, and as soon as I looked down, and suddenly Happy.
Maybe that's what we can do if people guarantee they're going to vote. We could do that.
Oh, we'll make Mike dress up like Punky Brewster, and
I love it. I love it.
Oh my God.
Better Mike than Bart. Although Bart, yeah. I mean, just saying, invitation's open.
He might want
to do it.
We're just assuming that Bart doesn't want to do it.
No, no, you're just not listening when I'm saying Mike can do all of it.
What? What? Huh? What?
Give it to Mike. Mike will do it.
Mike will do it. That'll be our new tagline for Falls Free Press. Mm-hmm. Mike will do it.
So, also speaking of the art, public arts, and I don't know about these people. They might be doing a flash mob too. I don't know.
Interesting.
Could happen.
The Public Arts Board is nearly created, and their first official meeting will be happening sometime in November. So far on the board is a bunch of people who I'm going to butcher their names.
You can do it, Bart.
Rick Kroschka, Daniel Dietrich, Molly Hartong, C. Arthur Croyle, and Tom Sullivan.
I think you know that guy.
Yes, I believe I do.
I think that was the only one you butchered was Tom Sullivan.
Probably.
So the Public Arts Board then will be the authority for determining whether or not a public arts project would move forward.
Yes.
In much the same way the Planning Commission, you know, helped determine whether or not the new car wash would you know, meet the requirements necessary to be able to move forward for that. So is that right?
Yes.
So if you want to paint a mural of a car wash, then you could just we know Molly and Tom, you know, Molly, Tom, if you're out there, just saying car wash mural. I'm thinking Front
Street.
I think
Tom would fabricate more of like a big middle finger and then a car wash.
That would just be his response. Be like, hey, can we do a car wash? He'd be like, let me get back to you on that. And then you just receive like a nicely welded giant, like middle finger on the porch.
Middle finger.
I have seen news stories where somebody did that because they were annoyed by something happening in the city. So they assembled a giant middle finger that they just placed in the middle of a field.
Well, see, that would be public art. So if you want that to go up, yes, then you'd have to go through the public arts board.
But anyway, as of right now, the public arts master plan is on the city's website. So if anybody's interested in, you know, what this group could be doing, that'll give an idea of, you know, what the city was thinking of, you know, possibly for this summer before that was taken away from us.
The summer that never was. A pockmark on the history of our lives.
But so, yeah, here in sometime in November, this group will be meeting and, you know, and deciding on different options for the city.
It's a great idea.
Do they have projects before them already?
Not that I know of yet.
Okay.
Like, they haven't really had an official meeting yet, from what I learned today.
All right. Well, with that, I'm so sad to report that we have reached the end of this week's roundtable discussion.
Aww.
Boo.
Cue the violins. Listen, aww. I'm so sad about Eddie Van Halen. Let's cue some
pound cake. Eruption.
I listened to a 13-minute eruption. It brought a tear to my eye. I was really sad. Let's have a moment of silence for Eddie Van Halen. Actually, we should have a moment of silence, or like a moment of like headbanging or air guitar. Air guitar for Eddie Van Halen.
I don't know how to do it.
You don't have to know how. It's just do it. See, that was perfect.
There it is.
I'm sure everyone listening to this is super enthusiastic about what's going on that they can't see.
Well, we'll describe my you know, my messy bun up here moving back and forth as I headbang and doing my air, you know.
Faces for radio. That's
that's what I have. Woo-hoo.
We have to thank our listeners for joining us once again this week. And as always, if you have an idea for somebody that you think we should interview, drop us a line, fallsfreepress@gmail.com. Please also remember that we are continuously in the market for article submissions, which can also be sent to fallsfreepress@gmail.com. So if you have an idea for an article and you want to write it up, you can send it in, or you can just ask us if it's something we might be interested in. And if so, then we can say yes or
answer will be yes. Write it. Get it to us.
we could use the content. We are preoccupied with creating this podcast of late, and we have not been doing as much stuff in print, except for Bart, who's always just clutch,
killing it.
He kills it
like a boss. But but we do like to have print material too. Not print, but writing
articles,
stuff for people to read.
Yes,
it's good for you. So send in your ideas. We'd love to have them. We'd love to have you work with us. And, there's always stuff going on.
Fun bunch. Come work with us.
As is obviously evident from the contents of this podcast.
Except for
we are
Alex.
So cool.
Mike loves me.
I hate you.
He does.
I hate
you. He tells me all the time.
I hate you.
You guys will just be watching a movie. He's got his arm around you. And he's like, I was just thinking of Alex.
He does.
No, I wasn't.
He's
no.
Like, you know what would make this better? If Alex
a
was
a giant,
here.
Deep hole with Alex thrown in it.
And s'mores.
And s'mores.
S'mores.
S'mores. Some s'mores.
For now, we will say goodbye, and we hope you will join us next week. So if you don't already have a plan to vote, make your plan now and vote.
Vote.
And while you're deciding how you're going to vote, go take a minute, watch some Eddie Van Halen videos on YouTube.
Yes.
Shed a tear like I did. And we will see you guys next week. Don't forget to stay tuned for my interview with James Lloyd Davis. Say goodbye, y'all.
Goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
Vote. Don't forget to vote.
Vote.
Bye. Okay, we're here on the Fallscast with a good friend of the Falls Free Press, and in fact, one of the co-founders of the Falls Free Press. It was not too long ago, maybe just a couple years ago, that myself and Mr. James Lloyd Davis met at Eddie's Deli on Oakwood Drive to discuss the possibility of a local free press in Cuyahoga Falls. And lo and behold, we made it happen. Mr. Davis is back with us today to talk about probably a variety of things, but not least of which will be his new collection of short stories entitled Shrapnel, which he's just finished getting published, and which the public is now able to get a hold of and read for themselves. Jim, if I may, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely. Glad to be here.
So I want to talk about the book, obviously. I've read about, I don't know, a fourth to a third of it or something like that by now. Got a pretty good taste for it. I had read some of your work before, and I don't know if the couple stories I read before are included in the collection or not, but you have a very interesting background, and I'd like to maybe just explore that for a little while before we jump too heavily into the book, if that's okay?
Sure.
So you're not originally from Cuyahoga Falls. Can you tell us about kind of where you come from and a little bit of your story?
Well, I was born in Baltimore, Maryland, raised in Norfolk, Virginia. I spent the first 16 to 18 years right on the Chesapeake Bay in one way or another. We had a house on a beach there, so that was kind of paradise. I've lived all over the country, worked all over the country, and it's really... that's quite a story in itself. I've had multiple careers, worked just about every job you can imagine. I spent some time working as a director for a homeless shelter in Texas. I've worked at the Biosphere in Arizona when it was under the auspices of Columbia University in New York. I was director of the facility and pretty much did all the engineering background maintenance and ran the show. That was a fun job.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, quite a bit of fun. I've been a tradesman in several trades. I spent about 18 years working in the shipyards. I worked in heavy industry as an electrician, an industrial electrician. You name it, I've done it.
Is there a reason for that? I mean, do you just get bored easily?
Well, no, actually, it came a necessity. I started out, I'm a veteran. I was over in Vietnam. I came back to the States. Finding a job was a little difficult at first. Because I basically didn't have a trade. I started to go to college when I moved up here to Cleveland. That would have been about 1969, I think. And I went, while I was working in a warehouse, an electrical warehouse, downtown Cleveland, I went to Tri-C on the downtown campus, took a lot of courses, started pre-engineering courses at Tri-C, and just about the time I was supposed to go to University of Cleveland University, CSU, I couldn't afford it, so I had to find something. I was married, had a couple of kids, and I had to get a job that paid some money, and found a job out in Lorain, Ohio, at a shipyard out there. I'd worked in the shipyard in Virginia before I came up here, so I had a little bit of experience. That pretty much is where it started. And when the shipyard died out, I had to do something. So I took what I knew about engineering. I got a job in a plant in Texas, for instance, as an industrial electrician, and did design work and most of the engineering for the place as well. So
So you moved all the way from Cleveland to Texas for that job.
Well, actually, if I was to give you an itinerary, it was Norfolk, Virginia, to Vietnam, to California, to Virginia, to Ohio, to Virginia, to Florida, to Virginia, and then Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, etc.
Wow.
More or less following the work, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was a different time, too. And I mean, I think that, you know, particularly in the 60s, following the Vietnam War, there was a sense that, you know, people needed to go to college, but it wasn't the kind of like prescribed necessity that it is now in terms of finding work. I mean, a lot of people in the baby boomer generation had parents who worked in industry without any kind of formal training outside maybe of military service. So
yeah, it really was a time when you could live by your wits, so to speak. And if you could grasp the concept, if you could do the work, it didn't matter if you had the paper. There was always people around with certifications. Like, for instance, I could turn in an engineering project and have somebody else's name on it. I'd get the money, I'd get the job, but, you know, I didn't get the credit, essentially. But at one time, I did have several engineers working for me.
Wow. So you you joined, which branch of the service did you join up with?
I was in the Navy, yeah.
In the Navy. And you left from Norfolk. Were you of age? Because there were a lot of, I know there were a lot of people who joined up with the military around Vietnam kind of to get away. And many of them weren't even 18 yet when they joined up. My father's actually one of these people.
Yeah, I was already in the Navy and over in Japan when the war started. I went in at 17. I was a high school dropout. Went in at 17, and I was there and waiting when it started. So within a week after the Tonkin Gulf incident, I was down there.
Wow. And what did you do in the war? I mean, which is to say, I mean, obviously, tell us what you want to tell us.
What did you do in the war, Daddy? I was on a tin can, a destroyer, and we did, we were over there for a good 2 years, 18 months of which we spent in operations in and around Vietnam. We did coastal shelling. We did. We went up the Saigon River. We did support, artillery support, basically for Marine Corps and for the Vietnamese.
Wow.
We did just about everything. We searched ships. We were involved in coordinating the first what they call the Brownwater Navy. We were a flagship for the actually they had Coast Guard and boats not unlike PT boats that did a lot of the river work in those days, and we were involved in that. We were in every core area in Vietnam.
Wow. Well, you do have one hell of a story just about your life, but you obviously have quite a knack for telling stories also. And that's what you spent, I guess, a number of years now concentrating on. You're working on a novel, as I understand it, in addition to having published Shrapnel.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I did Shrapnel. I put that together as an anthology and edited for, you know, all the stories again, just for that anthology. It was kind of an introduction into what I was using as a publishing source, which is KDP Amazon. I wanted to learn the process, and it was quite an experience.
Awesome. Yeah, now everybody can go and find Shrapnel on Amazon as a Kindle book. Or actually order a paper copy as well. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And I just found out today that it's available in France, Australia, and wherever.
Awesome.
So essentially, I'm everywhere.
Well, that's great.
Finally.
Well, you're a city treasure for sure, and I can say that because I've read some of this work now. You know, let's talk about some of these stories and about sort of your writing a little more in depth, perhaps. You know, I find it really cool that you begin the book with knitting the unraveled sleeves. It's a normal kind of length of a short story.
Yeah.
So you're able to kind of really get to know the characters, and you have these returning tropes throughout the story. It calls to mind Kurt Vonnegut, the knit pearl bit that you use throughout the story. But one thing I found in knitting the unraveled sleeves, and almost every story up until John Garfield Died for Our Sins, basically every one of those stories deals in some significant way with death. And if I were a scholar of psychoanalytic criticism, I might say that you have sort of a death infatuation or something. Now, I obviously don't know what's inside your head, but can you talk a little bit about that? Because, I mean, obviously we've all experienced a lot of death, and some more than others, but there is, in each one of those stories, quite a bit surrounding, you know, this theme.
Yeah, I suppose that one of the greatest themes that we have in our lives, and not so much in terms of art, but in terms of our life, is coming to grips with mortality, really. If you stop and think of it, most of us don't think about it. We don't face it. So when we finally come up and come up broadside with it, it's quite a shock. It really is. And if you want to put it in terms of, I never thought of it that way. I probably do have a rather morbid outlook in some aspects.
It's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think that there's, like what you're saying, what you said just before right now, is true. I mean, you know, there is a certain acceptance that takes time. And the sorts of people who don't experience a significant amount of death in their lives are that much more moved by it when it affects them personally, like when they lose somebody very close to them or something. But like a lot of people, and I would include myself in this category, you know, lose a lot of people throughout their lives. I can remember being a young child going to funerals and just lots of people close to me. And so it's something that doesn't have the same kind of impact on me that I think it would, you know, somebody else. So it could just be that you've experienced it a lot. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not.
Yeah. Well, let me put it in this way. It's a personal affront to know that you're going to die. And you don't come to that realization until maybe some situation where you actually have to face it. I can tell you a story.
Please do.
When I was in the Navy, and specifically over in the South China Sea, one time we answered a distress call from a French tanker. It was the motor vessel Arsenal. They had run into a half-submerged coral reef. It was called Scarborough Shoals. And they were taking on water, and they had managed somehow to keep the ship bow on into the reef and afloat. And they were looking for somebody to come and help them maybe back off the reef. We were the first ship on the scene, so naturally we sent a group over there. And I was one of the crew that volunteered to go. I was bored out of my skull at that particular time. I mean, 18 years old. And I thought it would be a real thrill. So we went over there in a small whale boat and climbed up the side of the ship on a Jacob's ladder, they call it. And we were on the ship while our ship, the USS Higbee, it was, tried to send over a hawser, the biggest one we have, which is about an inch and a quarter thick. And they were going to back off and try to pull at the same time that the Arsenal was going to reverse her engines, and maybe that was enough to get her off of the reef, at which point she could limp back to, say, Shanghai or someplace. Turned out, I was on the deck, on the main deck at the time, and I was in earshot of the wheelhouse, and I heard the captain say, you know, give directions, and he was telling the helmsman to try to go right or left, really quickly. And I guess his theory was that while we were pulling and while they had their engines in reverse, if he could just kind of fishtail, they could work off the reef. And it was working for a little bit. The only thing was, he went the wrong way once, and they didn't recover, and the hawser broke, and the ship went broadside to the reef. I was standing on the deck, and it felt like King Kong picked up the ship and just beat it on the rocks, you know?
Jeez.
Scared the daylights out of me. And our ship sent over a motor whaleboat again, and they were going to try to get us off the ship. They wanted the Higbee crew to come off first, and then they were going to get the French crewman off there. So we had to jump in the water. And we before we could dive off the side, I guess somebody came out of the engine room. Somebody told me it was the chief engineer, and he jumped over the side. And we could see that he was dragged over the coral, and he was killed. And we had to jump in the water, and they were going to, you know, pick us up in the water from the motor whaleboat. And I jumped in the water, and I remember it seemed like it took about 5 minutes to come to the surface, because as I went down, the water was coming up. There were heavy waves, probably about 6 to 8 feet. And when I surfaced, I could see that the guy in the motor whaleboat, our bosun mate, was pulling cord on the engine. The engine died. And we were getting sucked along the side of the ship and headed for that reef where that engineer just died. And they couldn't get the motor whaleboat started. And I was thinking to myself, geez, this is it. This is it.
My God.
But, you know, I've had a couple of instances in my life where I've had to actually look at death coming. I've seen a lot of people pass away around me. So I guess I have a familiarity that many people don't have.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I did wonder that. I mean, a lot of times, and maybe you can respond to this too, if you talk to an author directly and you ask them too much about the story, like, what did you mean? What does this mean? What are you trying to do here? A lot of times authors, and sometimes it's a cop-out and sometimes it isn't, will just say, well, I don't know, it's just a story. I wrote a story. I can't tell you, you know, really what's going on there. You just have to read the story and decide for yourself. Like a poet saying, you know, it means whatever it means to you, right?
Yeah, or it is what it is.
Right. And so do you feel that way, or do you feel like you're especially
I think every author, consciously or unconsciously, they have to draw. If there is anything in the story that actually has a ring of sincerity to it, you know that some element of that story is experience. I mean, you can have the best imagination in the world, and, you know, some of the most imaginative work is good to read simply because of the flight of fantasy. But when it comes down to the writing itself, the ability to convey even something that's made up, you have to have some element of a personal experience in order for it to really ring true. That's what I feel about it.
Yeah, there's actually a critical theorist named Frederick Jameson who talks about the political unconscious and how sometimes the systems that are depicted in stories, whether they're, you know, whether it's something that takes place during the Great Depression or some, you know, futuristic dystopia or something, are pulled from a political unconscious versus just, you know, unconscious instances of experience that drive the work in a certain way.
When you get down to the mechanics, though, when you get to the point where you're actually conveying the story through the eyes of the narrator, or even if the narrator is giving you a third-person description, in order for that description to have some element of truth, no matter where the setting is, I mean, you can be talking about the future, you can be talking about, say, outer space somewhere, but there is still the human interaction with the circumstances and the events within the story. They have to be true. They have to ring true. They have to feel human. And the best way to learn how to do that, the best way to learn how to experience that, is to draw on your personal experience.
So you're saying even if I wrote a science fiction story in a universe that didn't yet exist, the relationships between the people would still have to come from my own frame of reference?
I think so, yeah. I think so. Imagination goes so far. It's a beautiful thing, but it only goes so far. You have to be able to give some element of truth to it.
Right on.
Personally, you know, you go to the front of the book. I quoted a little poem there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, and I personally believe that fiction is probably more truthful than nonfiction because the narrator is actually separate, or the author is actually separated from the story. In other words, you don't have to inject your own personality into the story. The story, you can write about anything and nobody's going to come back and say, "What? You did that?" You know, there's no personal responsibility. So you can be eminently truthful in fiction where you can't be in nonfiction.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same way with poetry, right? Like, you can't infer the speaker's voice upon the author, you know. I don't think that that's the same in songwriting. It can be, but in poetry and in fiction, I think it's true that, you know, the narrator is not the author. We can't assume that it is anyway, unless the author tells us explicitly that it is.
So I
didn't look it up, and I just want to know, because it seems to me like that poem might be E.E. Cummings. Am I right about that?
No, it's mine.
Oh, it's yours. Okay. Yeah. Well, it rings early 20th century modernism to me, which I personally like. So it's a good one.
That's probably where my mind resides anyway.
Yeah. I you know, your style is in that canon for sure. So I think Knitting the Unraveled Sleeves is a really interesting story. Are you a fan of Vonnegut? Because, like I said, that knit pearl thing I think is really interesting, and that's something, I mean, obviously a lot of authors do that, but Vonnegut, you know, saying so it goes over and over again, things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Knitting the Unraveled Sleeves is really interesting, and again, I thought it was a great opener to the book because, you know, you go through an 18-page short story, and then you run into a series of stories that are actually really short. And I wanted to ask you about that because, like, you know, you look at, like, The Lady in White, which is a little less than 3 pages. The Color of Mango is less than 2 pages. Pain Endured, a little over 3 pages. I mean, really everything is pretty short until you get up to John Garfield Died for Our Sins. And that's kind of where I leave off. But I wondered if you could talk about that, because these almost read like asides, but they retain your voice in a way that's really, I think, elegant. And I wanted to hear what you had to say about kind of decisions as far as, like, did you feel any pressure ever to develop these stories, or did they just kind of come out and you were like, well, that's what it's going to be?
Now, we're talking about, this is 50 years worth of writing. For instance, The Lady in White goes back to 1973. The Color of Mangoes, 2003. Pain Endured, that's only 5 years old. Way Across Georgia was only 2 years ago, I think. You know, there's been lately in literary magazines a tendency to show more appreciation for shorter pieces. So I like writing shorter pieces, actually. I really enjoy it. I consider it a form of its own. Of course, they call it flash fiction, short shorts, whatever.
Yeah, I've heard microfiction.
Yes, that too. I have one story in there that's probably no more than 100 and some words, but I think sometimes the more compact the story, the more compelling sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I find it interesting that these stories are so disparate in terms of when they were written, because they do lock together pretty well. Maybe that's a symptom of them having been edited all for this collection, or really just a continuity of your voice. You're obviously a very mature writer, so I'm sure that's a big part of it. Did you feel that way writing it, or were you worried that it would seem disjointed?
No, I never worried about it at all. I tried to put them together in such a sense that you weren't disjointed going from one story to another. In other words, I tried to develop some sort of emotional flow between one story and the other. I didn't want to put in something that was going to suddenly put up a red light and say, whoa, back off, you know?
Yeah.
I like continuity. I prefer writing novels. Now that I'm doing that all the time, I probably never write another short story again.
Wow, interesting. So can you tell us, I mean, are you working on more than one novel or one at a time? Or?
I'll be honest, I've written about 10 in varying, well, not all 10 are completed, let me put it that way. I would say 3 of them are ready for, with, you know, minor edits here and there, ready for publication. The others are in varying stages of completion. A few of them just exist as a few paragraphs in outline.
Hmm.
But I can probably put out 2 or 3 a year from this point forward.
Wow. So you say you have one forthcoming. Can you give us a taste of what we might be in for?
It's the one book I've written that I can't disclose what the ending is. I can tell you that it's set in the 1960s primarily. It's about someone who's involved in some criminal activities, and they get involved with other people who are involved in foreign interventions by way of the CIA and so on and so forth. And it also touches on some of the mafia world, the underworld. But this one person kind of links the whole story together, and it moves towards a specific event. But the character himself, he is the story. It's the story of his life.
That's awesome.
He basically starts out as a military man. He is in the Korean War, And when he comes back, he gets involved with somebody. Actually, this is where we get into historical context, because have you ever heard of Frank Sturgis?
That name sounds really familiar, but I couldn't tell you why.
He was one of the Watergate burglars, by the way.
Okay.
And I actually met the man when he had a bar in downtown Norfolk.
Huh.
When they had a Main Street, and he owned two bars. I think he had the Peppermint Lounge and Virginia Beach and that bar in downtown Norfolk. But I didn't know him. I just happened to meet him once. And, you know, he turns out he had a very fascinating life. He was involved with Cuba. He actually worked for Castro when Castro was in the mountains. He worked against Castro for most of his life. He was a policeman once in Norfolk, and he quit that because they were crooks. He had a lot of integrity. He was a real true believer. Anyway, Frank Sturgis is depicted fictionally there, but he's key to the story. It's very, very complex story, but I'm enjoying, you know, the way it's turning out.
That's cool. It reminds me of a story, and I honestly, I want to say it's Don DeLillo's Libra.
Somewhat in that vein, but not quite. It's more centric to New York City, Greenwich Village. The main character actually lives in Greenwich Village, and he's more involved with the mafia than with the CIA. His connection to the CIA is through these Sturgis-like characters.
That's cool. So when you were beginning to promote your novel or your collection of short stories here on social media, you had some words about kind of your thinking about great fiction. And I teased you a little bit on there about your words regarding science fiction and that sort of thing. I don't want to revisit that necessarily, but you had some very interesting ways of talking about what you think makes great fiction, and what you tried to do in order to live up to that in the short story. Do you remember that? Do you want to talk about that?
Well, you know, in terms of, you're talking about genre, and when you get into that, it's a matter of personal preference. Story is really the prime element in literature. Story is it. Where you set it and how you go about your evolution of that story and how you present it. That, of course, is style, but there's always a matter of personal preference as to how it's done, where it's set, and so on and so forth. You know, there can be great, like, for instance, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury have written masterpieces.
Yeah.
In science fiction. I don't consider personally criticizing that. I just make fun of it from time to time.
Right.
Simply because I can.
Ah, the power of social media.
Indeed, yeah.
A giant megaphone.
But I do get a little irked sometimes with some of what seems to be selling. It gets on my nerves. Let me put it that way. Maybe that's age. I don't know. But zombie novels, come on.
Well, from a perspective of like a critic, you know, there are certain ways in which novels like that can be, allegories in ways that I think are valuable to the culture.
Exactly.
There's certainly a critical mass that happens with that type of literature as well, that we see in how it spreads to other media, like, you know, the prevalence of those kinds of tropes in television series and films and whatever, that go back to you know, like, what's his name? Richard Matheson, in the 60s, if we're looking at that kind of thing. And science fiction that's so old continues to pervade contemporary media. But I think, and this reminds me kind of the conversation we were having earlier about, you know, letting your experiences fuel your fiction, regardless of where and when they're set, because that's what's going to make it seem authentic. It sort of seems like you're saying the same thing about genre. Genre doesn't accentuate or preclude the quality of your work, but it can get in the way when it's you know, all you see everywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, I can digress, and I do often, you know, from actually, I don't know how you would call it. Let's say regular life, normal life, normal experience. You know, people work for a living, people raise families, they live, they die. You know, these are human experiences. And when we begin to go to the fantastical world, where we begin to talk about, like it's popular today, superheroes, I can't bend my mind in that direction. I can't go there for whatever reason. But I can really relate to what's been called magical realism in literature, especially from South America, Mexico, and so on. Some real masters down there. But when it comes to when you think about that, you're thinking about spiritual aspects of life, I guess, the spiritual experience rather than the physical experience. So, you know, I suppose I can get into that to a certain extent, because I can relate to it personally. And but when people begin to develop worlds that are not really allegories for what we exist in today, or what we know as human beings, what we understand, it gets beyond my ken. I don't get it.
Well, I think context is so important too. I mean, you know, you talk about somebody like Marquez and, you know, reading 100 Years of Solitude. Magical realism is it can be a tough nut to crack for a new reader, you know. But we have authors in, you know, American authors even, who write stories that are as fantastic without being magical. I'm thinking of like somebody like Thomas Pynchon.
Yes.
You know, it's just as difficult to sort of wrap your head around, but in a really, in a way that's really rewarding when you put in the work to do it. And I think that's just kind of, you know, the straddling the line between modernism and postmodernism in literature.
It may be a generational thing too, because you have to remember the generation that I grew up in intellectually is the same generation where one of the big to-dos was about the Don Juan series, I can't remember. Carlos Castaneda.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Familiar with that?
I'm actually not. I mean, I know the name, but I've never read any of his work. I mean, I think generational is certainly accurate. I mean, because, you know, literature has movements that are generally reactionary. So, I mean,
yeah,
the whole point of modernism was to set literature apart from, you know, popular print culture. Like, Virginia Woolf and James Joyce didn't want their work to be considered alongside, you know, magazines and penny novels, you know. So I think that their insistence upon making literature something you had to kind of work for as a reader.
Yeah. What I consider to be great literature is literature that virtually anybody can walk into. Something that strikes a common chord with you know, essential human experience. so to speak. That's what I call great literature. Yeah, I understand experimentation, and I understand that people find new language, new reference in different kinds of writing, different kinds of genre, if you will. But you know, as long as it has that essential tie to human experience, it's literature, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So you're here on the Falls Cast with us. We like to engage our guests in a little bit of discussion about Cuyahoga Falls area. How'd you end up in Cuyahoga Falls specifically?
Well, after Columbia University left the Biosphere, I was there for a while, and I worked as a more or less as temporarily setting up, documenting all the systems and whatnot, and getting it ready for whoever took over next. Actually, the University of Arizona in Tucson is finally taking over there. But after the university left, I had about a year's worth of money, and I decided to just sit down and write a novel. So I stayed in Tucson for a while, probably about 4 months after the place closed. And I began to realize that if my money ran out, I was going to have to go to work again, and Tucson was not the place to do it. I went first to Massachusetts. A friend offered me a place to write a cabin out in the Berkshires. I stayed there for a little while. And then from Massachusetts, I went back to Tucson, stayed near my dad for a while. Then I went back to Virginia. I went cross country about three or four times, and finally settled back in this area. Got married here, so I stayed.
And that was when you were in Cuyahoga Falls, or just Northeast Ohio generally?
Cuyahoga Falls. I settled in Cuyahoga Falls about 14, 15 years ago now.
Oh, cool. Well, you know, we all love Cuyahoga Falls. We're a group of concerned citizens, as you well know, more than anything, trying to create content about the falls and for people in the falls, which is what this podcast has become. As people who love Cuyahoga Falls, we often like to ask people, what are the things that they love about the city? So what do you love about Cuyahoga Falls?
Primarily the parks. I like to walk in the woods, and this is a great place to do that. I love the seasons. And nowhere else in the country are the seasons as prominent as they are in this area. Cuyahoga Falls as a city is great. I think the people here are wonderful.
I would have to agree with that.
And that's the endorsement of somebody who's lived all over the country.
Yeah, no kidding. A couple times, seems like. There and back about five times by my count now, so. Well, Jim, we want to thank you so much for joining us on the Falls Cast today. James Lloyd Davis's Shrapnel, an anthology of short stories from as far back as the 1970s, is available on Amazon.com as a Kindle book. And you can get a paper copy if you're one of those people like me who likes to cuddle up with an actual book in your hand. So make sure you go and check that out. Once again, Jim, thanks so much.
Absolutely. You take care, Alex.
All right. See you later. Falls Cast is a production of the Falls Free Press in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Please check out the Falls Free Press at fallsfreepress.com or on social media at facebook.com/fallsfreepress or at @falls_free on Twitter or Instagram. We thank you for listening to this episode, which was recorded and edited by Alex Hall. Please subscribe to our podcast and tell your Cuyahoga Falls friends and family so that they can listen as well.